Well, this story is shocking. It's gotten almost no coverage at all, kept from the headlines, of course, thanks to powerful people, and specifically it has to do with America's food supply. What is the truth about America's food supply? And what is the biggest threat to our entire supply? Might not be any kind of shortage, but the people who actually control it, the big agricultural companies, the consolidation of power into a few big producers. And the history of America's beef industry, of course, filled with allegations of mob connections, squeezing out some of the smaller producers, trying to roll them into the bigger producers, bribery, corruption, selling diseased meat, even meat reportedly so disgusting it made grown men vomit while they were having to put it together, serving it then to schools and prisons. I mean, you don't even have to go back to Upton Sinclair and the turn of the century to learn about this or study this, having pigs dragged through the streets of Chicago. We all remember that from our high school reading of The Jungle. It's happening right now with new accounts claiming diseased meat simply blended together with other products, ultimately sold to U.S. schools, prisons, even the U.S. military. That's how much we love our military, serving them diseased meat. So how the hell did we get here? And can you actually trust the meat that you're feeding your family if you walk into any typical grocery store? Where is it coming from? Joining me now is A.J. Richards. He comes from a family of ranchers, a long line of ranchers. He's a combat veteran, founder and CEO of From the Farm, which is a company working to connect Americans directly with independent farmers and ranchers, and love his story. A.J., welcome back to the show. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Clayton. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. So when you first saw this story, what went through your mind?
Yeah, I've been following the Santa Clarita issue for a while. And in the beginning, what I know of it was mainly just some contract issues, nefarious contract issues. Sounds like they were selling beef that was very specially finished on this carrot finished diet that has an effect on the meat and the quality, flavor, and tenderness of the meat, at least according to the family that raise it. And my understanding is they were first selling it into this, had a supply chain where it was going with a contract. And then that packer where they were sending it started basically cutting in their own supply from other sources and selling it through the chain. And so that's when I first heard about Santa Clarita, or at least the issues they were having. I learned about them prior because finishing beef on carrots is very interesting. You know, everybody's looking for an opportunity to feed out cattle, especially in the West when droughts are bad and forage is hard to find. So what are the byproducts that work? So I was first intrigued by what they were doing just from the fact that they were finishing it on carrots, and then starting to learn about the issues that were faced, they were dealing with legally. This whole mob connection is the first I've seen of it in this side, but for me, it's kind of par for the course, right? The big four that control us now, there's a lot of mob-like activity happening within those corporations. So it's kind of like, oh, not surprised you're going to find something that links to some nefarious causes to maximize profit for the corrupt and don't care about the people eating it. That's what we see nationwide.
So this Santa Clarita processor, can you describe like how big they are? They're not one of the big four, right? So this is like a smaller producer. And what were they were doing then, taking meat from small ranchers and then folding in some of this carrot-based meat and other things into the product?
Yeah, yeah. And this issue is just one of many I see throughout the country. So diving in on one specifically, there's too many, but this one in particular wasn't one of the big four. It was a medium-sized packer. And it's happened before when it's more of a corporate-run packing house versus a small family farm. And they're definitely not all like this, but some of them will find opportunities to, bump their own P&L. And so Santa Clarita, my understanding, has had this contract. They were sending their very specifically finished beef to that slaughterhouse for a contract. And when I was reading into it, and listening to some videos from the farmer himself, and it sounds like their contracts were supposed to increase and they never did. And when they looked into it, it's because they were backfilling the excess or the growth of that contract with their own product from that slaughterhouse, Where they were sourcing it, I have no idea. But the fact is they started taking advantage of that rancher's contract. My understanding is once they got the clarity on, found out that that was happening and pushed, there was an opportunity to go back to the rancher and source. But my understanding is by that time, the rancher was not capable of scaling to that volume as quickly. They were supposed to know what the growth was, that was needed over time so they could grow their operation to match. And so when that wasn't happening, seemed like they were pretty concerned and curious, like what was going on. And when they dug in, they're like, oh, you guys have been cutting us out, adding your own beef orders on top of what they were contracting with us. And so when it got found out, they turned and looked at the Santa Clarita beef and said, okay, you can fulfill it. But my understanding listening to the rancher was that's impossible. We needed to scale with you over time. There's a lot of decisions that have to be made, 2 years in advance in order to keep up with a growing demand. And so by then it was too late.
So this independent rancher providing as part of this contract, his great meat that he's probably taking great care of. Yep. He sends it there for processing, and then he finds out that this other foreign carrot-based meat or whatever is just being thrown into the mix in order to fulfill that order, so they don't have to pay him. But also, in effect, using foreign meat in his meat and watering down his product, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah, and it wasn't carrot-finished beef. He's the only one doing that. They were just getting whatever source they were had access to. I don't know exactly what
that was. Oh, so he had the carrot-based beef.
Yes.
And they're just shoving in whatever they can grab.
Yeah, just like, I don't have the details on it, but one of the largest organic grain frauds that ever happened. It was like $1 billion-plus issue. What happened was is they were selling organic grain, but it wasn't organic. So all the downstream consumers purchasing that product, assuming it was organic, that's not what they were receiving. So in this particular case, this independent rancher is raising a high quality product with their own unique finishing rations. Their customer believes that's what they're receiving. So they send their beef to the processor. The processor then incorporates other beef from other animals, not from that rancher, to basically a bad Coke dealer cutting the supply, as an example, just to make it go. And the rancher had no clue. And so they were fulfilling these higher order demands with their own product. The buyer was none the wiser. The producer was trying to figure out, why aren't we growing? We know they're growing. And then that's when they realized what was going on.
Right. These orders are coming in, but hey, we're not getting more orders ourselves for our high quality beef. They're just watering it down with this other garbage beef. Who knows where it comes from? And then, of course, as I mentioned the story off the top here, this idea of like turning and using some of this like diseased meat, putting this in packaging and then sending it to schools and the U.S. military and U.S. prisons. Like, how does this happen?
Yeah, that's the thing we've been trying to figure out and how to do it better. I mean, how it happens is when the pricing they're allowed to pay for beef is so low, there's your first indicator, right? If your budget to acquire beef is $2 or $3 right now, I would like to know where you're sourcing $2 or $3, ground beef, because you can't buy
Me
that.
Me too.
Exactly. Yeah. And if that's what it costs, what were the practices to get it that cheap? And a lot of that can still be done foreign, but even the foreign imported beef is so high. And so that's what happens is your schools and your prisons and so forth are given such a small budget, they're going to look for whatever commodity they need to fit that budget. Like a lot of this discussion about farm to school programs, it's great. But unless the discussion includes covering the difference of the cost it takes for your local producer to raise that meat to even sell it to the school, then why are we even having this discussion, right? If they're telling my friends that are ranchers here that, hey, we'll buy your meat for our school, but we need you to match Sysco's prices. Sysco's this mass food buying corporation that's sourcing from all over the world. There's no way the rancher can participate in a farm to school program unless the dollars are there, right? They just can't afford to participate in any the smaller producers, which is makes up the vast majority of our ranchers in our country, they cannot afford to participate in a wholesale market because their cost of inputs are so high. That's why beef is high, and because our inventory is incredibly low, lowest since 1951, 86 million head of cattle in our country, pre-wildfires, right? A lot of the ranchers I speak to now here in the West, we have no idea how this is going to shake out after wildfire season is over, how many livestock we've lost and ranch land that can no longer carry cattle to feed them because it's all burnt up. Like, there's some major issues coming that we won't see for the next 6 to 12 months, but that's how it gets there. The cost. What are you going to pay for? Oh, you're paying for bottom of the barrel. Well, we're going to go find bottom of the barrel because that's all we have. We've got to put something on their plate.
Do you believe that these wildfires are intentional in order to destroy the American beef industry?
No, I think they are a symptom of the decisions that were made decades ago to reduce the number of cattle on our public lands, our federal ground. You know, if you're old enough to remember Cattle Free by 93, these were environmental ENGO slogans that they just wanted to rewild, like get rid of all the humans from, you know, Jackson Hole all the way to Denver, Colorado, get them all out of the rural grounds. Let's give it back to the animals and whatever other nefarious, you know, anti-human agendas were behind that. That's what we're seeing today is symptoms of what those decisions made, you know, the Taylor Grazing Act back in 1935. That's when they first started measuring the number of beef in our Western ranges. And then since they started measuring it, they've been cutting them. Reduce. Same with logging. So now we're just having the symptoms of those terrible decisions when we bend the knee to these ENGOs for the last 70 years. It's what's happening. Now, do I think that there are people out there starting fires intentionally? Absolutely. We know that, you know, one of them was started in Seattle. I don't know that they're specifically related to disrupting our food supply more than just disrupting America in general, but we're dealing with the symptoms of 70 years of terrible policy, which is, again, the wildfires is the symptom, the cost of beef is the symptom, the low cattle numbers since 1951, they're all symptoms of these terrible policies that were made that we need to push back on and get changed again.
So forget the wildfires, it's just part of a larger plan to de-beef the United States of America and move us into some sort of Bill Gates Impossible Burger.
Yes.
You know, made from 80 chemicals and seed oils and get us off of, you know, beef, because the lies about eating meat are still persistent. You can Google things and you're still getting, of course, the World Health Organization or WEF, World Economic Forum, BS. About meat and eating meat and so trying to move it there. So it is part of a larger plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that from what I see, on one side, it was just the simple focus on maximizing revenue for that company, right? And so they made decisions, paid lobbyists, whatever they had to do for that purpose. But I also believe, on the other hand, there's another group that sees that weakness to their agenda, which is depopulation, globalization, and so forth, reducing the masculine men in America because we can get them all soy boys and get our women's hormones all messed up so they don't want to become mothers. All of these things, I definitely believe there are also groups that are just taking advantage of these policies that were pushed by corporate greed. Right. So they can just jump on the bandwagon and be like, oh, we can use this for our own agenda. And then we're seeing that, you know, I'm seeing now a lot of the young men, late teens, early 20s, they're waking up to this and recognizing, like, why the heck is my testosterone the same as my grandpa's? And so some of these
18 years old. Holy.
Yep. Yep. And so some of these athletic young men that have good parents helping them see what's going on, the Gen Z market is actually driving beef consumption growth. And I think it's because they're waking up to this globalist agenda to castrate them, you know, essentially.
No, that's great. I mean, my son just turned 16 a few weeks ago, a few days ago, actually. And well, even with our daughters, it's always important. Like, I don't care if you eat that, you know, the lettuce or whatever. Yep. I want you to eat the meat. You can, yep. You can push the potato to the side. I don't care, but you've got to eat the meat, you know?
Exactly.
So that's a value. But, you know, for a lot of people, there's this idea that it's, you know, eating, it's bad for you, all the propaganda around it. I mean, you guys are up against an enormous amount of propaganda still.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. And since this last election, that propaganda has significantly died down on social media, mainly because a lot of us talking about it are no longer being silenced, at least right now. So our messages are allowed to spread. And people are starting to hear it, but behind the scenes, we know it's kind of just a ticking time bomb. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in the next election or even at midterms. And if all of a sudden we're going to be back fighting this fight full court press again, but right now we're making some good progress and momentum, in certain policy areas and practices that needed to be reversed, but will they last? You know, if they're just, regulatory changes or EOs and they're not statutory to stick around, then we're just going to be a bunch of ping pong balls bouncing back and forth. So, but right now we've got a little bit of a reprieve from this globalist agenda of anti-meat. And so we're doing everything we can to get that momentum so that if something changes, we still have an army behind us to keep pushing. Cause that's what stopped at the first place was folks like us on social media calling out the stuff that people weren't seeing and getting people to rally behind us to push it.
So stay right there. I'm just going to pause for a quick moment here. And I want to come back. I want to talk about the headwinds that you guys are facing, not only just the grazing lands, the head of cattle, all of those pieces, but what are you up against, and maybe how dire is it right now for the American beef industry? So we're going to pause really quick and we'll be back here with AJ in just a second. But first, have you ever looked at one of today's biggest investment stories and thought, man, I wish I would have gotten in on that sooner. It could have maybe changed my life. Maybe it was AI. Maybe it was SpaceX. By the time everyone's talking about the opportunity, the biggest gains have already happened, right? Certainly in the early part of the build out for AI. What's next? We don't know exactly. But what if the next opportunity isn't the headline? It's what's making the headlines possible. And this is what I love to look at. And I'm talking specifically about silver. Now, silver is a critical material behind the AI revolution. It's used in the technology that powers data centers, advanced electronics, robotics. The infrastructure of AI depends on silver. And if AI keeps growing, and many expect that it will, I just spoke to a source at Amazon the other day who told me people have no idea how big this is about to get. They are sold out for years for compute. So that means way more data centers are going to be built. Across the country, not just for Amazon, but Meta, all of them, Google. So the demand for silver could grow right along with it. And here's the thing, you don't want to be learning about this after everyone else catches on. Remember, silver's price prediction is still at $150 an ounce. So I love a nice little pullback, perfect time to enter, but hey, it's up to you. That's why I want to get you a copy of Lear Capital's free report called The AI Revolution so you can deep dive this. It explains why so many investors are taking a closer look at silver right now and what could be driving demand in the years ahead. So call our friends at Lear Capital today, 1-800-613-3557. They're an American company. They will treat you lovely on the phone, okay? And get your free copy of this AI Revolution report. And while you're on the phone, ask also how you could qualify for up to $20,000 in bonus silver. So don't wait until a story is everywhere. I bought silver years ago, and I continue to buy it today. It's an important part of my portfolio. So call them 1-800-613-3557. That's 1-800-613-3557, or go to LearRedacted.com. And you know what's easier than fixing a problem? Not having to fix the problem in the first place. And your liver is one of those organs you don't think about until you have to. And supporting it daily is one of those small things that can make a huge difference and how you feel overall. And that's what I want to tell you about our friends over at Dose, because Dose for your liver is a clinically backed liver health supplement. This isn't just another capsule or powder. Dose is a liquid supplement. It's taken on a daily 2-ounce shot. All it is, it comes with a little shot glass when you order it, and you just fill it up, little 2 ounces, and it tastes like fresh squeezed orange juice. It's delicious. And it there's zero sugar, zero junk, zero calories. And think about your liver as your body's filter. It processes everything that you consume, performs 500 daily functions. So what can you expect when you're drinking Dose Daily? Well, you're going to get reduced sluggishness. You're going to get rid of those midday crashes. And it's going to support your metabolism and even aid in your digestion. It's got real results. They're really fantastic, with two double-blind placebo-controlled studies showing its positive impact on liver enzyme levels. I want you to try it today. If you're ready to give your liver the support it deserves, head to dosedaily.co/redacted, not .com. It's .co, dosedaily.co/redacted, and enter the code redacted to get 35% off your first subscription. Your body does so much for you. Let's do something for it. That's dosedaily.co/redacted for 35% off your first month's subscription. All right, we're back with AJ to talk about where the beef industry heads next. So you mentioned the wildfires at grazing lands and the head of cattle. I mean, and of course, then beef prices skyrocketing on top of that. So maybe you can just paint a picture for maybe smaller producers like yourself, and you're, of course, reaching all these small producers, trying to bring them together so people can get their local ranches and buy meat directly. What kind of headwinds are you facing on a large scale?
Yeah, on a large scale, it's mostly informing consumers is one, right? Informed consumers can shift our entire path. An informed consumer that goes and looks for the producer that's close to them and shakes their hand is a consumer that understands they're part of the fight, and that with them, we can actually win, right? Because where you spend your dollars truly makes a difference. If you spend your dollar directly with a producer, that money goes straight into their bank account. If you buy it at the grocery store, that producer is only going to see a percentage of that. Now, historically, 14 cents on the dollar. When I say historically, within the last 6 years. This year, the last 2 years, for the first time, cow-calf ranchers, and that means a rancher that has mama cows and baby cows, and that's their operation. And they send those calves, when they weigh a certain weight, off to a lot to finish raising until it's ready for slaughter. That's kind of the structure. And so for the first time in many years, those producers are making 50 to 55%. But it's not because we fixed something that was broken. It's because supply and demand. We already put ourselves in a very vulnerable position. And so because there's such a limited supply, their cattle are worth way more. We also, the secretary closed the border to Mexico because of the New World screwworm last year. So that shut off a major thoroughfare of beef coming from Mexico. And so because that supply chain got shut off, it increased the value for the cow-calf operator to earn some money finally, right? And they haven't earned money for, you know, 6-7+ years prior to that, maybe even more. And so people are like, oh, the ranchers are making all this money. Well, they're making better now, but also how much more are you paying for gas? Right? Yeah. How much more is your electric bills? How much more is your input costs? With the water wars that are going on in the West, the taxes that are starting to come out for ranchers that are watering pivots for their feed to feed their cows through the winter, that cost is going up. So
how much is that going up? I'm just curious on the, for the ranchers watering.
I just read here in my own state in Wyoming, the assessed tax, I can't remember the exact dollar amount, but the ranchers are saying, we're out, we're done. As soon as, if this gets implemented, we're all bankrupt. We can't afford to spend the money on the water to raise feed.
And then you have the AI data centers, right? I mean, yeah. The water consumption alone and the electricity consumption. I was just speaking to a source at Amazon the other day who told me the build out for, you know, Amazon data centers is just skyrocketing. The demand, yep, is off the charts, and electricity costs will go up in, yep, these towns, and the water usage, of course. So they're using cooling now. They're going to have, you know, as much as they can, but they're using like a new age of like water filtration, the whole thing. So then it falls back. Then the ranchers are getting priced out, yep, but the AI data, you know, AI data centers can use as much water as they like.
Yeah. And the thing that most people don't realize is the way that the West was established essentially for ranching was that when you, because it's federal ground, they don't own it, but they have the lease for the cattle on the ground, right? So if I've got 100,000 acres of public land, which people can drive out and go hiking and all these things, it's a shared use. I'm just raising cattle there. When that sort of structure was set up, it also included water shares. Now, that grazing permit is it's essentially like owning a mineral right to mine. It's yours. You don't own the land, but you own the forage on the land essentially, and it can be transferred to a new buyer, and you can make that money if you sell it. It's not the government's. You don't own the ground, but you own the forage on the ground, so you have the right to graze it. And so the water rights in the West right now, because the West is under this big water war, right? The Colorado watershed, all the states from, you know, California, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, we're all on this Colorado shed, and all the states south of us, they're now fighting, and everybody's fighting over who gets what water, right? Like, they're building their cities are exploding. Phoenix, Arizona was built in the desert. Las Vegas, Nevada was built in the desert. The water they need to have those cities run, now it's in their argument. Well, the ranchers own their rights. Those water shares are vested to them, and it's part of that transferable, you know, process. Like, as a rancher, if I owned a bunch of water shares more than I needed, I can sell you my shares, but I'm not, and not have to sell you my grazing rights because they're independent. So I can sell one and keep the other, or vice versa in many cases. So now what's the question is, okay, so you have these data centers coming in. How are they all of a sudden magically getting a hold of water shares that I went and tried to apply for and there was none available, right? But right. Now all of a sudden there's all kinds of water available, and don't worry, we can recycle it. So we're not going to take it from the existing ranchers. Well, if that was the case, why couldn't I get more water to raise more food for America, you know, a month prior? But now all of a sudden there's this unlimited water supply.
Right. You go to, what's the permitting process look like? So if you want to go and get water for the grazing for your animals, what does that process look like?
That all depends on which water you need access to and what your state looks like. You know, in my particular case, I'm trying to get water to get more stuff growing on my farm here in Cody. The water that I have access to, I have to go to the state engineer's office because that particular water is under their purview. If I was next to a canal somewhere else, I would have to go to the canal board and get a permit to have my turn on a canal. But when those shares are all gone, you can't access that canal water until, you know, somebody sells off their share of it because they're allocated. If you're in other states where you want to drill a well, like in Utah, I have a desert restoration project. It's a 60-acre test site to show that we can regreen the desert with cattle. In order for me to get water, I have to drill a well. But before I drill a well, I have to go to the state and apply for a water share. But they won't give me one because they're all out. So now I have to go find somebody willing to sell me a water share for that particular aquifer. And then I can drill and pull from that aquifer because now I own their share. Some things I've heard about in Utah in particular is as the water gets worse, they're going to start canceling or suspending your water shares based on date. So if I have an 1870 water share, it's one of, you know, if it's an older water share, I'm probably good to go because mine has historical precedence over anybody that built within the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. So I may be able to keep mine because it's an older share. And that's what I've heard they'll do is they'll just start canceling the newer shares first until they get to whatever, you know, criteria they feel like they need to get to. The frustrating thing with all of this is if people understood agriculture and regenerative agriculture in particular, we would solve the water problem and our food problem and our human health problem. We would solve them all because regenerative agriculture puts us focus first on soil health, knowing that the byproduct of that is quality meat. So it's just changing the focus. You know, the focus right now is all these meat scientists saying, if you birth it at this date and you raise it on this forage and then you give it this product to finish, and if you're in the commodity market, throw this hormone behind its ear, then we're going to be able to get you to a certain weight of cow by a certain time so then we can slaughter it and sell it. All that focus has been on that, getting to the fattest cow as fast as you can for process efficiency, right? That's where the focus has been. It's not been on human health, and it's not been on soil health, certainly, for a long time until now. But if soil health was the focus, all the other things become natural byproducts of that. Happier, healthier people with more stable and climates and environments, because we've got enough forage from all the ruminants on the wild, on the western lands. We rebuild our local water cycles. We refill our aquifers. Like, all of that's possible. But some of these folks think it's, you know, what Thomas Massey call it, crunchy conservative.
Right.
And they just don't want to listen.
What's amazing to me, and you're speaking about something that was near and dear to my wife and I, our hearts, when, you know, we learned about Alan Savory and his incredible work. He did I encourage everyone to go watch his TED Talk. I think it's like from the year 2013. He's since passed away.
No, well, he's still alive. I met him 2 weeks ago.
Is he?
Yeah, really? He was in Utah 2 weeks ago. Yep.
Oh, then my apologies.
He's almost passed away. He'll tell you that himself.
Yeah, he's like 100 years old now. I thought for some reason he passed away. Sorry, Alan. Very much alive. But his 2013 TED Talk was eye-opening. I mean, everyone should watch it, because – and it was really one of those like jaw-dropping moments when my wife and I were watching it. And we see a lot of crap on this show. You know, we see a lot of stuff, but we couldn't believe it. Like, you have a desert, but then you have these tightly bunched group of ruminant animals, like on a desert, and they're able to bring back just with almost no food at all. There's no foliage there at all. There's like almost nothing for them to eat. And somehow, just by them being bunched together in this desert area, it turns into this like lush greenery with grass, and it's like crazy. I don't know. It seems fake, but it's not. And you know, so I don't know. That just reminded me of that, and just being able to take some of these desert areas. So I'm excited to hear more about like what you're doing with this 60 acre area. Yeah. I mean, how much water would you even need for that to turn that from desert into like a lush, you know, area?
We would only need enough water to water the livestock while they're there. And so the idea for us is that we're going to treat that 60. So first of all, I'll just back up. This place is called the Escalante Desert. It's north of St. George, Utah. If people are familiar with that, Zion National Park area. So kind of northwest of Zion National Park, not far. And it's a desert. It's called the Escalante Desert. But we found historical journal entries from the Escalante Catholic Party when they went through there in the 1700s, the late 1700s. And Father Escalante was his name, which is why it's called Escalante. Was the Escalante Valley. We refer to it as the Escalante Desert. But his journal said, "We have never seen more beautiful, lush grassland in all of our travels than right here."
And now it's desert.
And it's desert. Greasewood and sagebrush and cracked ground across the entire, it's like, I think it's like 3,000 square miles of land that's all dried up. And so I knew that it didn't look like it did historically, which means there's probably a native seed bank ready for the right environment to be restored with the right animal impact and so forth. Because what Alan describes is what he talks about, the brittle and non-brittle environments. So non-brittle is like a forest, right? Or a jungle. You can grab a stick off the ground, and when you go to snap it, it's going to bend quite a bit before it breaks. That's a non-brittle environment. Brittle environments is like the West. You grab a stick and barely put any pressure and it snaps because it's dry. Brittle environments require the ruminating gut of a ruminant, beef, you know, cattle, elk, bison, all of these ruminating animals. It requires that process to add moisture and break the leaves down, the plants to turn into biological matter because it's so dry, right? You need that impact coming from the gut of those ruminating animals. Huh. And so I was mentioning earlier, the Taylor Grazing Act in 1935, when it was implemented, we had 18 million AUMs. That means animal units a month, which equates to one female mama cow and one baby cow equals one AUM. So in 1935, we had 18 million AUMs. Now, keep in mind, that is after the bison that used to roam the West were all culled, right? Killed off. So we've already lost those ruminating animals for, you know, more than 100 years prior, so that the impact of desertification had already started by the time 1935 came around. And folks just had no clue, right, what we were doing to this type of environment. Now we have 8 million AUMs. So since 1935, environmental organizations like Western Watershed, EVIL, Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, these ENGOs have been working to get ranchers off the ground because they can do it better, or they don't think they should be there at all. So what'll happen is a group like Western Watershed will go and sue the BLM in a particular area. So, like, let's say an area that my cousin is ranching on BLM, Bureau of Land Management ground. Western Watershed will go to the BLM that's over that area and sue the BLM, claiming the rancher is hurting the sage grouse, a bird, right? We'll just use that as an example. So they go to the BLM and say the rancher's hurting the environment for the sage grouse. So they sue them, and it's a sue and settle. And the settlement is, okay, hey, rancher, you're hurting the sage grouse, according to Western Watershed. So now you can no longer run 1,000 cows. You can only run 500 cows because you hurt the sage grouse. Now, they've been using the sage grouse as their weapon for decades. The ranchers have gotten no support from the federal government to push back on it. In many cases, a lot of us believe there's some of these special interest folks that are actually employed by some of these groups, you know, boots on the ground locally, and may even be flagging them for things that they can sue and take. And so they sue them. Well, what's interesting, they've been doing that for decades. Last year, University of Idaho came out with a 10-year study that said actually cattle improve the environment for sage grouse. So it has nothing to do with whatever species they want to blame or claim. It has everything to do with just getting the rancher gone because they don't like cows. They think they're hurting the environment. But if you go watch Alan Savory and really learn the truth, you realize actually maybe the reason our wildfires are so bad like they are now is because we got rid of 10 million cows that used to keep the soil fertilized and used to keep the rainwaters and the rain cycles coming. And so that's some of the headwinds that we're pushing against so that we can get the consumers to rally behind the producers and know that your producers are responsible for your human health, with the quality of food you're eating, for even having food in the first place, right, to prevent from famine, but also improving the environment we live on if they were left alone and in some cases educated on some new information that, you know, Alan put out. But our whole nation would be much better off if these ENGOs were out of the way and the local Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service worked with the farmers and ranchers versus against them because of special interests.
When these vegans and, you know, soy guys like Bill Gates want us to stop eating meat in favor of eating Impossible Burgers, where they clean off, you know, huge swaths of land. I think a lot of people don't realize like how many animals are killed as a result of that. Far more than a head of cattle on grazing land. So you're killing off, I don't know how many sage grouses you did. Do you did these organizations go after people like Bill Gates for clearing this land out in order to make Impossible Burgers?
No, in fact, there's some. It's been a while since I looked into this, but there was some ties to the World Economic Forum funding some of these ENGOs. So,
Shocking.
Bill's probably paying for it. Hey, just like the freaking data centers, right? Where's all these, you know, tree huggers screaming about data centers? Still don't hear, you know, Western Watershed is still focused on the cow. They're wrong. They're completely wrong, but they're still focused there. And so it's crazy. But kind of back to your question. So we need enough water to water the livestock and then take them off and then let the natural rain cycles do their thing. About 4 years ago, there was enough rain in that valley that it came off of the hill and knocked over a locomotive train. So a train was going through the valley. It's a complete desert, but there was enough rainfall to wash the train over. So what that tells to somebody who's looking at the land trying to rehabilitate it is there's plenty of rainfall here. The problem is because it's desertified, that crust on the top, it's so hard that the compaction, because there's no root systems from plants breaking up the compacted dirt, that water won't get to the aquifer. So when that rain came and it was supposed to replenish the aquifers, you know, Texas doesn't have this problem because they've got the limestone. It can just easily penetrate. But back in the West, with the dirt and the clay, if we don't have the root systems from all the forage breaking that up so the water can penetrate, then it just evaporates. And then when it evaporates, you lose it. You didn't keep any of it. But then it also pulls the saline to the surface. So now you have a highly saline environment that is even harder to replenish. So our plan is to do what's called biocarpeting, which means you treat your 60 acres like a feedlot for a period of time until there's enough manure and animal impact, and then you take them away for a couple of years and give it a chance to re-kickstart that ecology on the ground we're on. And our goal, it's just 60 acres, but our goal is to show that it's possible so that the other producers and other people that have land around us can maybe start learning and making the same impact.
Stay right there. I want to talk quick after just a short break about these big four, the big four consolidated power. Who are they? How much control do they have? And I also want to ask you, if I walk into a grocery store today and buy a package of beef that looks like it's from America, like, can you tell me what's actually in that beef? And is it from America? And can you guarantee me that that cow was like naturally raised here? So I want to touch on all of that. Like sort of the David and Goliath story here with these small producers up against these consolidated powers. But first, if you're struggling with cravings, bloating, stubborn weight gain, your gut health could be playing a bigger role than you think. A damaged microbiome can affect everything from inflammation, digestion, to cravings, even weight gain. And with today's processed foods and environmental toxins, a lot of people's digestive health is taking a huge hit. Think about all the microplastics that are in our body, and your gut health may be more important than ever before. That's where a fermented food called kimchi can make a real difference. Kimchi is a naturally rich in over 900 probiotic strains that help support gut bacteria. Because when your gut bacteria are properly supported, your body is better able to process food efficiently, regulate cravings, support digestion, maintain a healthier metabolism overall. Studies even show that eating kimchi can reduce your body fat by 31.8%. But supporting your gut microbiomes takes consistency, and most people, most Americans, just aren't eating kimchi every day because of the taste, the smell, or the hassle that comes with it. A lot of Americans, it's not part of their diet. That's why Brightcore created Kimchi One, delivering the same benefits of fermented kimchi in a convenient capsule that helps restore your gut's natural balance every day. I take it every day. I take two of these capsules every day. And I told the story recently. I was traveling and I forgot my supplements. For 2 weeks I was traveling and it was brutal. I couldn't wait to get back and use it again, because when your body is functioning properly, then you notice it. You notice it from the inside out. Everything else becomes easier. Everything becomes easier. Yes, you catch my drift. Just to, you know, not to go down that path. But anyway, today you can get an exclusive offer by clicking the link below in our description for 25% off your entire order, or an even better deal. That 25% is great, but if you call them, you'll get 50% off your order and free shipping. So give them a call right now, 888-404-6312. We'll get back to the interview here in a second. But first, the next world war may not begin with soldiers. It may begin with code. Autonomous drones are being designed to identify targets. It's terrifying. Zero-day cyber weapons can disrupt a country's power grid without firing a single shot. When the world's militaries decide that artificial intelligence is the technology worth betting everything on, that tells you something about its overall raw power. But that same kind of intelligence is now sitting on your laptop, waiting for you to point it at something useful. Are you going to learn how to wield it? And you don't need months to get started. You can actually do it in just one weekend. So this video is sponsored by OutSkill, and they've made a free seat available to my audience for their two-day AI Claude-a-thon. It's a complete Claude AI mastery workshop happening this weekend from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern. This isn't just another presentation where someone talks about AI. It's a hands-on deep dive into Claude and more than 10,000 additional AI tools. So over 2 days, you're going to learn how to use Claude for deep research, build your own artifacts, dashboards, create complete presentations, connect AI to the repetitive tasks that consume your day so you don't have to do them anymore. You're also going to get hands-on experiences with Claude Code, build custom AI agents, automate workflows, including something as time-consuming as an entire job search, how to learn to generate professional images and videos, all using AI. So the goal for you is to walk away knowing how to use these tools to automate hours of work and potentially put much of your week on autopilot. You'll be mentored by industry leaders with experience at Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and NVIDIA. So if you register right now, you're also going to receive 3 free bonuses, 50 secret Claude codes designed to unlock more powerful results, a complete AI prompt library, and a personalized AI toolkit builder. So OutSkill is offering a 100% discount to the first 1,000 people who claim a seat. So don't wait, grab your free discount right now. What you learn during these 2 days could change the way you work for the next 2 years. So click the link at the top of the description or in the pinned comment, scan the QR code on your screen, and join the WhatsApp community before the remaining seats are gone. All right, back with AJ Richards to talk about the American beef industry and what is exactly happening right now to America's food supply and how really under siege and under attack it is. I think this is an important topic that is getting almost zero coverage. So thank you for the work that you're doing, trying to connect people with, you know, local farms and being able to go direct to the ranchers. How does that work exactly? Can you tell us about your company and what you do to connect people locally to ranchers?
Yeah. So we built a website. Our vision is like Airbnb or Etsy for local food. You got to simplify the consumer behavior, which is convenience. We're used to convenience for food. So when somebody goes to buy from a farmer or rancher, they don't know how, or they're intimidated, or they don't understand the process, and that, hey, it's not like running to the grocery store and just pulling something out of the counter all the time. You can find the right producers that have it available like that, or a brick and mortar. But the whole point is to rebuild a food system that actually works for the people and the producers and cut out as many of the middlemen as possible. We still need somebody to cut it up and process it, and you still need UPS or somebody to get it from there to you. But we can remove a lot of those other middle components, especially the big four. So, you know, so that's what the website is like. The producers, they own their store, they build it. When you order on our website, you're not buying from me. You're actually buying from that family that you ordered from. Your customer service is done with them, not us. We're not here to be a middleman. We're just here to attempt to build a new system structured and built with the current technology we have that makes that process easier and make sure the farmer gets as much of the retail dollar as they can, so that regardless of what the big four are doing to manipulate the market, it won't matter, because the stability is right with the consumers. And this is the big message I'm always trying to get to the consumers mainly. Our food system is in shambles. We are a lot closer to famine than people realize. But you, the consumer, have more power than elected officials. And what I mean by that is there's some really incredible people that I'm working with in Washington, D.C. that are trying. But the system that's established requires so much input from so many other areas that it's so hard to move the needle in a common sense direction. And so we as the people can make that difference on our own if we just opt into a new system. And that's what we're working to build, is that new system. Full transparency, source verified. We don't need to worry about labels or somebody mixing rotten, stinky meat if I'm going right to the source and that it's labeled right. Because Clayton, you're my producer. I know you. If I have a question or how you raised it or whatever, I can just reach out to you. And I got the direct answer from the person who raised it in the first place. That's a system that we're trying to build. And so currently we've got 115 producers across, you know, I think 38, 39 states that are all coming on board. And we just make it really easy for them. On the producer side, because I come from this world, the technology is built for producers. So we're also working to make that convenience work for them as well. Most technology was out there when I started selling direct to consumer. It was clear that it was built by tech people, not farmers and ranchers. So it was complicated. And the last place we want to spend is in front of a computer for hours a day. So we're making their process as easy as possible, because we are them. We know them. We know what they need. And so we're taking this on in a way that it's built for the convenience of both parties. And that's what we've set up so far, and it's doing really well. The reason that I did that is because, again, I was trying to help with the regenerative side first, and then COVID hit and our whole supply chain, it became very clear that this isn't just a desertification issue. This is a food system issue, right? So even though my primary focus is regenerative agriculture to restore the desertification that's happening in the West, well, how do you get there? Well, as we talked, like what Alan Savory does with his cattle, it'll work, but those cows are not going to be very tasty and they're not going to be very fat when you send them to slaughter. So they're kind of a, literally just a tool to change what's happening. When you talk to a farmer about that or a rancher who's barely making it work right now, and you say, hey, you're going to have to throw away a few years to get there, no possible way.
Right.
They can't afford to hardly be in business as it is. So if we're going to get these other things to change, we had to pull back and say, what is the mechanism that's going to change? Well, it's economic. Anything that you want, which is why the big four have manipulated the markets for themselves. They know the value of economic drivers. So early on, man, this is the easy button. We can just get them to 600 pounds and send them off and somebody's taking care of it. Well, you fast forward 50 years, the producer's no longer connected with the consumer, and now they're reliant on the big four, the people in between them, to actually connect with the consumer. So we're just trying to take all of that back. And if we can fix the economics of our family farms and ranches, we can revitalize and rebuild an agrarian movement. Because the reality is right now, we only have 1.8 million farms and ranches of all sizes, small to large, in America. 1.8 million. But 86% of them are small, according to USDA. Well, small means $350,000 a year in gross revenue on your farm operation or less. So what that tells us is 86% of our 1.8 million farms left all have to work off-farm jobs. They all have careers or work of some other kind just to maintain the farm. So they're all 1 foot away from having to sell out or from a data center showing up and saying, hey, we'll give you $50,000 an acre for your farm. Oh, well, can't rub two nickels together anyway, because the system right. isn't built for me. So I'll cash out. And now we've got a data center instead of a farm. And so we've got to start at the root cause, build the economic value for our producers so that they can go from off-farm jobs to full-time producers. And then we can start rebuilding our herds. We can start rebuilding our farms in America. But all of that doesn't happen unless the consumer first decides to change their behaviors. If we're waiting on the government, it's never going to fix.
Can you talk about these big four? Who are they? Yeah. And what kind of power do they have?
Yeah. So we've got JBS, which is the largest. JBS is Brazilian owned. The Batista brothers built them. I'll go to in detail with them a little bit. Then we've got Morfrig, National Beef, which is a Morfrig company, also Brazilian owned. Then we've got Cargill and Tyson. Cargill is a family, American family owned company. There's a lot of things you can find about them that aren't so great, including deforestation in Brazil for the increase of foreign raised beef or raising their crops and things like that. And then Tyson. Tyson is a multinational, corporation. So two of our four largest meat processors that, by the way, control 85% of the meat market. Okay, so four companies control 85% of America's production. Two of them are Brazilian owned. The biggest one, JBS, the founders, the Batista brothers, went to prison for bribery. They bribed the Brazilian government, including the president, to scale their business in the 90s, late 90s, and that's how they got to be as big as they are. They spent time in federal prison. They paid a fine. I can't remember the volume of the fine, but it was really just cost of doing business. They come out of prison and then eventually find themselves back in leadership of the company that they that they were caught for, being involved in this bribery scandal with. And so JBS is by far the largest in the world and the largest here. I actually have a contact who was a campaign manager for Javier Bolsonaro in Brazil, the Brazilian president that was bribed under by JBS. And they were telling me that, we understand that America's view of JBS in Brazil is not good, but what you need to know is JBS did this to all of our Brazilian ranchers first. And so she said, we have whistleblowers scattered across the globe that are either scattered because of political retribution or whatnot, but they're all trying to talk and show what's happened globally because of JBS, not just what's happened in America. But it's deep, it's corrupt when they control 85%. I mean, so let's talk about something good that may be coming, and it's called MCOL, Mandatory Country of Origin Labeling. And this is kind of an opportunity for us to set the record straight between the consumer and where their food comes from. So right now, when you go to the grocery store, we don't have mandatory country of origin labeling on beef. So if you go to the grocery store, you don't really know where that beef originated, okay? Because it's not required. But in 2014, I believe it was, 2014, 2015, they did implement MCOL. And when they did, actually increased the revenue for American producers. Why? Because when you go to the grocery store and you're looking at a package of meat and there's a sticker at the top that very clearly tells the consumer what country it came from, more often than not, they chose American beef. That's what we need. Let the consumer decide, but let an informed consumer decide, right? And so if we can get MCOL, oh, by the way, MCOL was then repealed in 2015 under the WTO, some reference to discrimination under the WTO. So it was repealed, which is probably just a bunch of BS. The Big Four attacked the lob with a lobbyist and got, paid off the right politicians. But they actually didn't vote to repeal it. They hit it in an omnibus bill with no vote. So they took away the mandatory country of origin labeling in 2015. And there are some very compelling graphs out there by RCAF USA that show what happened with beef prices, with cattle prices, and the spread between the cattle price and what the packers were making. What's funny is right now, sympathizers to the packers are like, oh, they're not making any money. They're right. They're not right now because they put themselves in a position of such a small herd number, the supply and demand, that now they are losing money. But they have not lost money for the, every year until the last year or two. They've been major profitable. So if people want us to feel sorry for the Big Four for being for not making money right now, we're not. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be good for us as consumers. Like I've always said, we're going to pay for the sins of our past one way or another. And now we are. Because the margins are dropping, what's happening is now they're closing some of their big plants. Well, when they started consolidating in the first place, they started the consolidation. What happened is they went out into the rural communities, right? And they set up these slaughterhouses and they started selling boxed beef instead of sides of beef. So what would happen is the rural communities, all these small slaughterhouses throughout the country, they would process a cow and cut it in half, and they would send that half of beef into the cities, into the suburbs, to butcher shops that would then further process it for the consumers. Okay, so there's multiple steps there. Well, process efficiency, if you want to dominate and own everything, how do you cut out all those people in the middle and keep that for yourself? So they built bigger plants in rural communities. So the smaller independent run ones closed. Then they, instead of cutting them in half, they did what's called boxed beef. So if you, a whole primal, right? Or just, I'm trying to describe it for consumers, larger sections of beef, but that fits in a box. So they'll send a restaurant or a butcher shop now in the city a box that has five primals in it, like the loin or something like that. And there'll be five in there that now all they're doing is cutting them with a knife. So it collapsed all of our small slaughterhouses that we used to have spread throughout the country that were the lifeblood of getting small operations meat moving from them to the consumer. So now those collapse. So now we have very few left throughout our country, the small packers. Well, now because of the loss of revenue for the big packers, they're starting to close some of their bigger facilities. And that's hurting because now where does the cattleman go? If that plant closes, now I got to go 12 hours or, you know, whatever. And so we put ourselves in a position where we allowed these companies to come in and scale and crush our small independent slaughterhouses and ranches so that we're dependent on these bigger operations as a whole. And now we're losing the bigger operations because that wasn't sustainable. And now we're seeing it, you know, COVID shined the light on that. And so now we're in a rock and a hard space and we got to move quickly or we're going to have problems. So, but M-Cool just got passed by the Senate Ag Committee. The House did not approve it, but Senate wrote it up in the Farm Bill. So it looks good, but we've got something that will do well for us that's currently packaged inside something that nobody can agree on because of SNAP. Because the Farm Bill has to pass in order for us to get M-Cool, at least how it's written currently.
So I guess, you know, I asked earlier before the break, you know, if I walk into an American grocery store today and beef that looks American, I remember walking into a Walmart one time and picked up the package of ground beef. And on the back of it, it showed that it was from three different countries.
Yeah.
There was Chinese beef mixed in with Brazilian beef. And I think maybe some Australian, I don't even think there was any American in it, but it looked American, but until you actually read the fine print. So how much of what we think is coming from America is actually coming from America, and how much of it is like repackaged with foreign meat?
Yeah. If it's going through the big operations, probably most of it, right? Because what they'll do is they'll ship in what they call the trim. So as they're cutting up the beef, you've got all these little parts and pieces, things that, you know, if you don't want whatever comes off the steak as you're trimming it, those kinds of things, they call it trim. And it goes into these big giant bins, big square boxes, right? And then they ship it over in a reefer truck and then they pour that into a big grinder and they just grind it all up together and squeeze it out into a brick for ground beef. And so I've read reports where sometimes you're finding 5,000 different genetic codes in 1 pound of ground beef.
Jeez.
Now, personally, I don't know if, you know, I'm going to eat one cow today and I'll eat another cow tomorrow. I don't know if that matters so much, but that just illustrates sort of the process that's going on here. So when you say you look at the back of a package and it has three different countries, it's because it all came over in big boxes and they just put it all in one big mixer and ground it up. But some of the most nefarious stuff that consumers don't know is something like lean, fine textured beef is what it's called, LFTB, pink slime. People hear it as pink slime. Well, it's called pink slime, but they're allowed to call it beef because it's pink. Some USDA person about 20 years ago that was in the right position to make some stupid decision changed this entire thing. And so because it's pink, they're allowed to call it beef, not fat. And so what they're allowed to do is add up to 30% of that to your ground beef purchase and still call it ground beef. So when you're buying an 80-20, but 30% of that's potentially this LFTB product, it's not actually 80-20. That's why when you cook it and it cooks down to this little tiny portion, you're like, what the heck? That's a pound? That's what's happening. And a lot of times they'll wash it with ammonia. And there's some evidence that, you know, what that does to our microgut biome after we consume that. So sometimes you'll meet somebody that's doing it right and they'll say, we don't wash it with ammonia, but they're still putting the LFTB in there because it's allowed by law to label it, you know, as ground beef. That's why
is that why these sorry to interrupt you, but is that where like these local producers come in where you're not going to get that from them?
Exactly. That's where they come in. When you go to them, that's also why they're losing. Because for that rancher, when he sells you a pound of ground beef and it's more money, it's a true pound of ground beef.
Right.
Right. You're no longer comparing apples and oranges. So I hear all the time, well, I have to pay the rancher so much more than the grocery store. Well, there's, you know, economics where the process of volume brings down some of the cost, but then there's also these other things they're doing that allows them to spread it out so they can make a lot more money per pound. But the rancher you buy from directly is not doing that.
This pink slime, is it labeled on the package? So if I go to, again, Walmart, I want to buy a thing of ground beef, Will it say on there the pink slime or some version of that LFT? No, it's hidden.
Mm-mm. No, you're allowed to put 30% up.
It's like putting ethanol in your tank.
Yeah, it's just assumed, right?
Yeah.
Just assume that a consuming population that's been separated from the source of their system for an entire generation still knows the process. No, they don't. And neither does the people making the rules even care. They don't care. It's all profit driven.
And so Congress is aware of this. They have to be. Yes. Yep. They have to be. So who's the lobbying effort behind this? There's got to be money. There's got to be an enormous amount of money to keep this 30% pink slime in our food supply.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know the exact lobby groups behind it. But speaking of lobby groups that's important to share for the consumers, we've had this lobby group that poses as a rancher first lobby group. And that's the NCBA, National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And so you would hear that and be like, oh, they got the best interest of the ranchers in mind.
Right.
But they don't. Back in 1996, an independent cattlemen's association, I think it was the National Cattlemen's Beef Board. I might get these terms a little wrong, but it'll still get you over the bullseye. They combined with the National Packers. So they became one because the national, the cattlemen side of that organization, they were not making money. They couldn't afford to stay in business. So there was a merger. I've talked to old timers that were around back in that day. And they we knew this was going to be the thing that let the fox in the hen house. Because now the Packers are all on the board of the NCBA, right? So they're all part of that. And so I contend, nobody can serve two masters. You either serve the independent ranchers of America or you serve the big four. You cannot claim to serve both because you won't be, especially when the majority of your revenue is coming from the Packers. And so that's a lobbying group that it wouldn't surprise me if they were behind some of that to keep LFTB going that way. I don't know that for sure, but what I do know is that, the NCBA is in my opinion, they fell asleep on watch and allowed these global entities to come in and take over the independent ranchers, and they need to go away. And this is, that discussion may get more reaction on this podcast than anything else we talk about because they're powerful. It's a hard place to be because I'm here to serve all families that are in ranching. And some folks that are in the NCBA, ranchers that are members, a lot of times when I've met them, it's because it's what dad did, right? They just grew up in that group. So it's kind of the good old boy club and you don't want to leave it. But I know far more that have left and joined independent cattlemen's organizations that have been fighting this for a long time. And I will say this, the Secretary of Agriculture right now is the best we've ever had. Now, she can only do so much, right? She has staff and people that have to execute on the things that she asks them to do, and they can drag their feet or not. How much can one person do, especially when you take over an entity that's been corrupted for so many decades? She has said herself, mandatory country of origin labeling is a black and white issue, and that should be passed. Consumers should know very clearly where it came from. That is a completely opposite view of the NCBA. They don't want mandatory country of origin labeling. So I've been telling consumers, if you want to know who the fox in the hen house is, it will simply be the people that do not want mandatory country of origin labeling. And it's going to be people that look like they are for the independent rancher, and they're not. Farm Bureau is also anti-MCOOL because they've been captured by corporate interests, right? Mm-hmm. These entities that have been with our grandparents for a long time that we think we can count on and trust, they've ultimately fell to the dollar and been bought out.
So the cattlemen's group, what's their reason for not wanting to have American labeling?
They did an article recently that it would cost $1 billion in economic loss.
For who?
That's probably true. Exactly. For who? Who are you actually saying is going to be a loss to? Well, it'll be the Packers. Because if the consumer can go and see USA versus France, Brazil, South Africa, and they choose America every time, then the Packers are going to start losing money. Now, with that said, there are some incredible families that they were some of the lucky few that made the right financial decisions, I guess, or business decisions, so they were able to grow with the takeover of the Big Four, and that's what they do. And these are great Americans, right? But their market is the Big Four, and they can't get out. I've met folks that they're so in bed because they raise so many cattle that they have to have that size of a buyer, and so they're scared to death to say anything against the Big Four or the NCBA because that could cost them a contract, and then where are they going to go? And so, it's got to be, you know, that is what's happening, and it's to maintain the status quo for those that have had power forever, because the consumer is now aware. I mean, I'll say that I'm very proud of the average consumer that listen to shows like this that want to be informed, because they are rallying. I mean, look, I've been doing nothing but looking at this for, you know, more than 6 years and watching the trends and where we're going.
Yeah.
No matter how hard some good people in government try, there's the bureaucracy that our government has now built on is so convoluted that they're not going to make enough changes quick enough. It's going to have to be up to the consumer. We're either going to save ourselves, or we're going to have to look ourselves in the mirror when and if it gets worse. Because right now, if you like this website we built, I'm not the only one. There's many out there. In fact, there's a lot more family farms and ranches that are just on their own website on Shopify or whatnot. If we as an American people decided that we were going to sell them out, we were going to prioritize our beef and our pork and any of our food from our as much as we could locally, we would be able to shift that regardless of what the federal government did. Now, that doesn't mean we wouldn't have to fight, but if more bad policies show up and that rancher can call 1,000 consumers and say, I need you to go vote, he now has an army of 1,000, and so does the next guy, and so does the next guy, and so does the next guy. That's how you build enough momentum to stop this crap from happening. You know, that's what stopped COVID from railroading our country, is those of us that were willing to push back enough of us and say, we're not playing this game. It's going to be need to be the same thing. I just don't know if enough people are going to wake up fast enough.
Earlier, you mentioned famine, and that you believe we're getting pretty close to famine, or we're just a few steps away from it. I've spoken to other experts who believe that that's very much the case, that America is just a few steps away from famine. And, you know, to the average American who's just sort of living his or her life, it seems far away from us, right? The way that we access to fast food, whatever it is, right?
Yep.
What do you mean we're very close to famine?
So I mentioned earlier, 86 million head of cows in America. That's all cows. That's not just beef cows. That's your dairy cows. That's your bulls. That's your, you know, things that you don't put in the supply chain. That's your mama cows that are supposed to have more babies for a few more years. That's all of them. That's how many we have in America. If ships stopped coming to the America, like that's a scenario. If supply ships stopped coming in, and it takes one beef to feed a family of four for a year, and we have 320 million people in America, 86 million, we're already in a deficit, right? If we have another COVID event or some sort of we have 30 slaughterhouses. So the big four that process 85% of the meat we consume, 80% of that meat we consume gets processed in less than 40 slaughterhouses. 40. So we rely on 40 buildings to feed us 80% of the meat we consume. Those buildings rely on power. They have to have any functioning infrastructure. So if you have water issues, if you have power issues, if you have cyber attacks, which happened in 2021, most people don't remember this, but COVID caused the first supply chain disruption. And then in 2021, you went back to the store and all of a sudden you thought things were getting better and 2021, you went back and they're like, oh, we're limiting how much you can buy today. And you're like, what is going on? I don't know if people don't remember that. That was during 2021. JBS, the largest processor in the country, got hacked by a Russian hacking organization. And they locked them out of their process for a week. All their plants were shut down. They had to pay an $11 million ransom to be let back in. So you got cyber issues. So when we're relying on 80% of our meat to go through 40 buildings, you know, how many people remember during Biden all the planes that happened to find perfect runways on top of processing facilities? That I haven't heard of one, not saying it hasn't happened, but I haven't heard of one since the new administration. But I remember hearing about four or five at least during the previous administration. And these are big buildings, but you don't have to even disrupt the whole building, just where they come in at.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. You know, one of the books that's an eye opener that people should read is Red Famine. It's the what happened in the Holodomor in Soviet Russia in 1935. It was all government decisions that led to famine. You know, Stalin, and he's a communist, so of course that's where it went. But that's what people just they don't understand. And the other side of that is it takes 24 months. I mean, we're talking about you can't speed up nature. It takes 24 months for that baby cow to be old enough to have another baby cow, you know, somewhere in there, not exactly 24 months, but takes 24 months to finish that cow to eat it. So now you're waiting year and a half, 2 years before that cow can have a baby. Then you're waiting a year and a half to 2 years before that cow's old enough to even consume. So you're 2 to 4 years out just to get to the next generation of what is out there. So that's the issue. And then you add the environmental impacts. You got the wildfires. Well, when all that feed burns up and the winter comes and they've got no forage, right? Hay right now is $350 a ton. And so now you lost all your forage from the fire. So now it's only August. You have to start feeding your storage that you put up for the winter, if you even got to that point yet because of the drought. And so we're going to see massive herd dispersals, they call them, when the rancher sells out, simply because they have no more forage. The droughts or the fires took their forage. So that's what I say. We don't even know what 6 months to a year from now looks like. It's happening in real time. I mean, I got a ranching friend that is in Nevada. There's a, you know, 500,000 acre fire burning right now. And him and his ranch hands are all fighting it the best they can on their side of it. But that's all forage that isn't going to come back until next spring if we got the rains at the right time.
Right. I was going to say, if you're lucky for it to come back.
Yep.
Well, when you paint that picture, it's absolutely eye-opening. And all of these interconnected pieces that make it what it is. It's not just the beef. It's the climate. It's the wildfires. It's potential hacking, shutting down the infrastructure. It's terrifying. Well, in the meantime, one of the things we can do is, you know, connect with our local ranches. So where can people go? I want to link it up in the description so people can take advantage of this, start, you know, getting actual real beef, real ground beef, not pink slime. Where can people go to learn more about this?
Yeah, if they go to our websites, fromthefarm.org, we have all kinds of products on there, not just beef, produce, dairy. People are making cheeses. These are a family. Some of them are cottage makers. So they're sourcing sourcing products, you know, like fat. Like my wife and I sell tallow that we render from the slaughterhouse that we used to run. So it's all local fat that we pick up and render. So we got all different kinds of people on there. But fromthefarm.org, you will be supporting a family directly. And if this has been my contention the whole time, we have to start with those 86%. Let's stop losing them first, because if we can build a market for the 86% to succeed, the small farms that go right to you, then that opens up the door for other people that are just dying to get out of the city and onto a homestead. They'll now see an economic path to become food growers, because the average age of our farmers right now is late 50s, mid 60s. We've got to replace that population as well. And unless we build an entry point where you don't have to raise 1,000 cows to go into the commodity market that's just going to take advantage of you anyway, but you're raising, you know, you might start with 2 this year or chickens, you know, whatever that might be. This path from thefarm.org, if we focus on sourcing from right from the source, We build an entire new market that is what we're waiting for. That I spent 3.5 years just asking questions before I started the software development. I knew I was going to build it, but I wanted to know for sure what was needed. And that's how I ended up running a USDA slaughterhouse first, was I just asked too many dumb questions and found myself there. But everybody told me the same thing. Everyone, we need a competitive market, because right now producers are price takers, not price makers. And what we teach the producers how to price their beef for the consumer, and it's simply based on their own inputs. That's why you can go from one farmer to another and their prices are slightly off. Well, this farmer might live in an area where a certain input costs him a lot more than this other guy. So it's really based on what they need to keep going and be around. The price of beef will come down. It's going to be a while. And that's why we as consumers have to see it as an investment in our future. You're either seen as an investment in your health or an investment in the fact that you'll even have it down the road, right? During COVID, when the store shelves were empty, the last thing I was worried about was food, because I knew who my rancher was. But people I talked to that were in the cities and didn't know, they were scared. Where am I going to get this if I can't get it here? So fromthefarm.org, connect with a rancher, shake the hand that feeds you. We as the people can do this, and we don't even need the government to be involved. Now, we'll need them in some areas, and that's what my team will do. We'll push policy where it's needed, but we the people have the power.
Love it. We'll have it linked up in the description. Man, this has been really eye-opening. So many pieces of this that I don't think people understand fully. So thank you for taking the time to walk through this. Really eye-opening stuff. Thank you, AJ.
Thanks for having me, Clayton. I
You
appreciate
bet. And thanks to all of you for being here and being a part of our show. We really appreciate it. Thank you for subscribing. Check out our daily newsletter, redacted.inc is the website. Just go there, click on the newsletter link at the top, and it'll be delivered to your inbox first thing in the morning. We tend to cover like 4 or 5 of the big stories of the day that the mainstream media are ignoring, or we try to sift through all the propaganda so you can be more informed over your cup of coffee. So thank you so much. Thanks for all of you watching today. Really appreciate it. And God bless, and we'll see you real soon.